Okay, this is session number 24, December 18th, 2006, and we're continuing with the William Irwin Thompson part of the book, Fatty Communion with Bob Dobbs. We're on page 53, and we're going to go to 59, and that's just 53, 55, 57, 59, right-hand page numbers. Last week we were doing Thompson, and we did his take on personal consciousness development through the arts of yoga. And he had the male version and the female version. Now, this section is a transcription of a talk he gave at the Coevolution Quarterly, which used to be the Whole Earth Catalog, in the 70s. I think 77, they did a conference and they had all these speakers come and they printed up what the speakers said, what some of them said, and they featured Thompson. And of that issue, it was the Coevolution Quarterly, issue number 20, winter 78-79, and Thompson is on page 106 and 107. So this is his history of sociological consciousness, or collective consciousness, or human consciousness. And Scott's going to read this section.
Yeah, so what was the Coevolution Quarterly?
That was a follow-up from the Whole Earth Catalog. Do you remember the Whole Earth Catalog?
Oh, yeah. So that was a Stuart Brand publication?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And so they renamed it in the middle 70s.
Right. So, all right, so let's begin this here.
So this is William Irwin Thompson giving a history of the world in 5 minutes, he says.
Okay. It is absurd to give a lecture in 5 minutes, so I'm going to be even more absurd to try to give a mini lecture on the end of history,
on one end
of history to the other in 4.5 minutes. The geologists who spoke before me have tried to give us a sense of where we are as a way of gaining a sense of where we are going. So I want to talk about history by talking about cultural change, about six great cultural transformations: the hominization of the primates, symbolization and origins of notation and art in the upper Paleolithic, agriculturalization in 9000 BC, civilization in 3500 BC, industrialization in the 18th century AD, and the cultural transformation we are in now, planetization. The first one, the hominization of the primates, should be called the feminization of the primates, because it all started when we got kicked out of the forest in the Pliocene, and we became so scared being out in the open, subject to predation, that the females unconsciously lured the males around them by abandoning the old estrus system and becoming open to sexuality at all times. So the males left palling around with their buddies in the old male pair bonding pattern and clustered around the females. Next thing you know, there's a whole new setup. With males scrounging and females gathering. That created the basic division of labor between male and female. So, the origins of human culture come from women. And so, thank you. Since I am a cultural historian, that's important to me. The women did it again in the next big change, symbolization. When language began to emerge, it really split consciousness by creating the unconscious and the conscious. Like an island raising out of the sea, language was a piece of the old ocean floor held up to new light. And the symbol, like a piece of coral or a rock, could help to relate the one to the other. One seemingly small thing which helped to relate the one to to the other was menstruation, for it established the first observable periodicities between the phases of the moon and the internal life of the womb. With ovulation at the full and menstruation at the dark of the moon. In observing the synchronicity between our bodies and nature, and in keeping track of the 10 lunar months of pregnancy on the lunar tally sticks of the midwife, woman was the first to establish the system of notation and symbolism upon which all later calendrical systems are based. So the roots of science, contra capital M Marshak, are with women. It's the story of the Great Mother holding up the lunar calendar incised on the crescent of the bison's horn, in parentheses, the well-known Venus of La Salle, and not the story of the Great Father with his phallic wand. The third basic change came again from women when, through gathering wild cereals, they discovered that they could collect enough food in 3 weeks to last an entire year. Women and children could collect more food than man the hunter could ever kill. But the food required storage and heavy grinding bins. And so they began to settle down to create agriculture and a Neolithic village. Unfortunately, agriculture gave us enough of a surplus that men had some time on their hands. Since they now had, quote, property, which could be taken away, the men found that trading and raiding could be as exciting as the old days of the hunt, and so warfare came into being. After domestication of plants and animals and agriculturalization came the next big change, the domestication of women, or civilization. Warfare enabled the old custom-bound religious matrilineal society of the Neolithic village to grow into the great city with its patriarchal structure. It's the great male gods, its religiously controlled economic surplus, and its standing armies. Small wonder that the Sumerian goddess Inanna comes to the great male god Enki and says, I, quote, I, the woman, why did you treat differently? Where are my prerogatives? Unquote. Enki responds by saying, quote, Enki perfected greatly that which was woman's task, unquote. A woman, as the cook, is a mere housewife, but a man is a chef. Women may have invented the lunar tally stick, but man takes it over to create writing, the measurement of wealth in the temple storehouse. From 3500 BC to the 18th century AD, all the civilizations of the world are agrarian. But then in the Great Britain, another big change comes along and we get the next transformation, industrialization. Industrialization is really an intensification of civilization. And so through science and technology, the culture becomes even more patriarchal and militaristic than its Sumerian ancestor. In hominization, the old forest home had been absorbed into the clump of trees, the new home base for the hominids. In symbolization, the animals were absorbed into artistic images on stones and cave walls. In agriculturalization, the plants were absorbed, and in civilization, women were absorbed. In each case of cultural absorption, there was an attendant process of miniaturization. First, the forest had been miniaturized in the clump of trees of the home base. Then the animals had been miniaturized into an artistic image, and time was miniaturized in the lunar tally stick. Then plants were miniaturized in the garden, and finally women and Neolithic matrilineal culture were miniaturized in the patriarchal household. In the 18th century, all nature was surrounded and miniaturized by culture. The wrought iron and glass structure of the Great Exhibition of 1851 surrounded the trees and fountains of Hyde Park, proclaimed for all the world to see that in the crystal palace of industrial technology, wild nature had been turned into a potted plant. In parentheses, small wonder that most Victorian drawing rooms became civilized jungles of potted ferns. We historians now see all this, of course, with 20/20 hindsight. Then people thought they were...
Back then.
People thought they were returning to nature and romanticism. And the great exhibition featured such camouflage of industrialization as Sherwood Forest, Robin Hood chairs, Gothic sewing scissors, and rose-decorated sewing machines. Through the medieval court in the Crystal Palace, everyone grooved on nostalgia, with cute little vines engraved on the legs of machines. You can see it all in the world's first Whole Earth catalog, the catalog for the Great Exhibition itself. What was true of industrialization is true of planetization. A nostalgic and false consciousness tried to camouflage the structure with a romantic content. All the artifacts and cultures of the world were miniaturized in Stuart Brand's Whole Earth catalog, and although people grooved on wood, stoves, and fantasies of self-sufficiency, the catalog itself was absorbing everything into its giant The catalog itself was absorbing everything into its giant collage. All culture was now being absorbed and miniaturized as preparation for stuffing it into one of Stuart's beloved space colonies. Just as the Victorians had once grooved on rose-decorated sewing machines, so people now grooved on wood stoves, windmills, and solar collectors. But the folksy nostalgia merely camouflaged the technological collectivism. When the co-evolutionary quarterly later openly came out in favor of Herman Kahn and O'Neill's space colonies, it showed the true skull and bones under the costume. All nature was to be turned into a potted plant in a tin can, and all culture was to be trashed into a television sensibility collage. But the Whole Earth Catalog and the Co-Evolutionary Quarterly do not express the full dimensions of planetization. In what Sri Aurobindo would call, quote, the descent of the supramental, there is a new level of human consciousness which is now surrounding, absorbing, and miniaturizing the old civilization and technological consciousness.
The old civilized and technological consciousness.
Mm-hmm. As the supramental surrounds the old mental level, the mind becomes an artifact, and intellection becomes a mid-dance.
A mind dance.
Ratio becomes logos once again, and the central icon of the
econometric state.
Econometric state. The dollar sign falls on its side, and the bars that cross it melt and turn into a sign for infinity.
Like the 8 on its side I have in my chart.
Yeah.
The dollar sign falls on its side, and the bars that cross it melt and turn into a sign for infinity. So there's a quick 5-minute run through of the history of culture.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
Well, it's pretty good. I mean, I think it's interesting how, I've heard you talk about the computer's effect of miniaturizing technology.
Yeah.
But here we're talking about miniaturizing technology from a much larger scale to a more intermediate scale before we get to the computer, which then takes and miniaturizes it even more.
Well, he's in the computer quadrant, homeopathic computer quadrant on my chart. So he turns a computer into an art form. So he takes the miniaturization attached to computerization and projects it back through history. Takes the effect of computers and makes it a historical pattern.
Mm.
Pretty creative.
Yeah, nobody's done that before.
Right. So what's interesting here is that as McLuhan would run through the history of culture via technological spaces, acoustic space, visual space, and tactile space, and cover huge spans of time. Thompson does the same thing emphasizing cultural content, main cultural content. It's slightly got technological form in there, but he blurs the figure in the ground. So Thompson...
Well, he's also pushing it way back before McLuhan.
That's right. He goes back to... McLuhan includes caveman. Thompson goes back to the ape. There are references to the ape in... he talks about that book in the late 60s called The Naked Ape. So McLuhan covers the whole history of humanity as a replay of Finnegan's Wake. Now, Thompson is an Irish scholar, a scholar of Joyce and Irish writers. His first book was on that. I think it was his PhD on 1916, the Irish Rebellion year. And he contrasts the different responses of Yeats and Joyce and Irish writers to that revolution, rebellion, suppression that led to the formation of the State of Ireland in 1922. So Thompson's coming out of the Joyce influence, and this is what he comes up with.
Yeah, now I was reading up a little on Thompson this week and discovered that he doesn't understand Finnegan's Wake or use it metaphorically as comprehensively as McLuhan does. He says that Finnegan's Wake is the grand finale of the dynamical...
Atlantic phase is another term, the Atlantic civilization, Atlantic industrialization.
Yeah, oh, yeah, right. And then and that's before the morphological, which we're in now. But
which he calls the Pacific Shift. He called that in the 80s, the Pacific Shift.
Right.
He has a different term now.
Yeah, and he says that rather than being the... foundation of the Pacific Shift, he sees it as being the climax of the Atlantic shift. So he doesn't think that Joyce was as comprehensive as Marshall did.
That's right. Now, Thompson, put up with my input in the seminars in the middle 90s, 93 to 97, he had to rekindle an interest in investigation of McLuhan, and that brought him back to Finnegan's Wake. And if you look in his final later books, like Coming into Being and Transforming History, I think is the book for classrooms, he reassesses Finnegan's Wake and doesn't limit it as much as he did in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So you take a look at how he writes about Finnegan's Wake later. He begins to see it, well, maybe it's more of the morphological age. So he shifts from his use of Finnegan's Wake and positioning in the 80s. He changes that in the later 90s.
Right.
But you'd have to go and read the different phases.
Yeah. Right. Anybody that happens to listen to this tape who hasn't read Thompson doesn't know what we're talking about here by these different phase shifts in cultural history.
Yeah. And the... And what he learned from McLuhan and he used in his PhD thesis, the book on 1916 in Ireland, he took the basic pattern of the previous environment becomes an art form when you move into a new technological, new cultural scene. If we move forward to the very last quote in the Thompson Quadrant on page 73,
mm-hmm.
You'll see where he says, and he wrote this in the late 80s, "We slay with technology and save the victim with art." Now, that's an updating of what we've just read, and what we just read is an updating of the pattern he applied to Ireland in the 60s, all coming from McLuhan. The idea that there's an invisible new environment, and the older environment becomes visible and therefore manipulable and an art form.
Mm-hmm.
So, But he changed it. He makes it a miniaturization pattern in this thing we just read, which is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Another way, it's an appropriate way of updating McLuhan, but using the technology at hand, computerization, and instead of saying turning into an art form, the same process is called miniaturization. And the same figure ground effect emerges.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to put this whole section in the book to show his encyclopedic view of history of culture, just like McLuhan had done and LaRouche had done. So fortunately, this talk had been transcribed. It was very useful to use it to give a summation of what Thompson fills out and expands in a book he did after this talk. He may have been working on the book time he did this talk in 77, 78, his book, The Time Falling Bodies Take the Light, comes out in 1981, that does a lot of this, goes into details. And then he builds on it with his mid-80s book called Pacific Shift, and then updates it into another kind of terminology, but still dealing with the phases in the book Imaginary Landscape, which comes out in, 1989. And then he changes that in the late 90s. He brings in other aspects. He fine-tunes the history, especially after collaborating with Ralph Abraham, the University of California at Santa Cruz mathematician, a chaos mathematician. So he and Ralph said, you're weak on the mathematics history. So Thompson had to change it, and that's where he got a phase he added in the late medieval period up to the Renaissance, he called the period of algebraic period. I don't know if you've read those books where he goes into that. He goes from the geometric mentality, and before he gets the industrial mentality, he puts in an in-between phase called the algebraic mentality.
Now, does that sort of incorporate some of the Arabic architecture, and maybe those, what are those temples called that have the kind of like dewdrop kind of, or they have the...
The Gothic cathedrals.
Yeah.
Now that's the Baghdad Arab influence around 700, 800, 900, 1,000.
Yeah, if you look at their
AD.
Their handwriting or their script, it's very...
Calligraphy.
Yeah, but it has kind of a Baroque aesthetic.
Yes. I don't know if they call it calligraphy. That's, I think, the term for Japanese or Chinese writing. Anyways, that convoluted, that non-phonetic alphabet kind of writing.
Mm-hmm.
Different effect. A different kind of acoustic society mixed with the writing of letters. The interesting thing is that we saw here that he went from, he had civilization goes from 3500 B.C. all the way up to 18th century A.D., 1800
mm-hmm.
or 1700s, and then he's going to get into industrialization. That's a long stretch. He's going to break that up into phases, the 3500 B.C. to the industrialization phase of the 18th century in later books, like The Imaginary Landscape and then Transforming History in the maybe around 2000. Transforming History, which is a summary of a lot of his stuff as a classroom text. So this is the beginning. He's spanning history. Now, McLuhan said that you can do a history of the world in 30 seconds. You know, by the 60s, you can do that, because we've got information overload, we've got huge patterns, and history has become obsolete from McLuhan's point of view as a category and a subject, because all times and places were existing at the same time by the 60s. Now, what Thompson does is he stretches it out into visual linear history again. He takes all these phases that are all happening in the world right now and stretches out for printed book aesthetic.
Yeah.
So that's why I have him...
Well, also, even though all past times are presently, you know, occurring, still they happen sequentially, because all present times were not happening in the past. So the past kept building on itself and building on it, and went through these phases of transformation, which had to do with the evolution of the human consciousness, the physical perception in the material world, the development and mutations going on in the astral planes and so on as well.
Yeah,
in the psyche, you know, his discussion of how, you know, the transformation from the old, you know, books of the dead to the more modern sort of psyche astral dimensions and so on. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, the electric age retrieves its content, the history of humanity, and the present becomes an immeasurable sea of acultural, like amoral, acultural. It's hard to measure and determine where people are now, and McLuhan called a discarnate man, he would say that ancient pre-literate societies had a sense of all time happening. But again, it was in the agricultural level, the pre-agricultural hunting phases.
Well, I think we went into this a little bit last week. They were pretty much right hemisphere. They didn't really have much. They didn't develop the left hemisphere very much.
Right. So
then we developed the left. Then we developed the left hemisphere in visual space, and then the electric age. Now we have both the left and right hemispheres are developed.
Yeah, we're operating in the corpus callosum, which we'll call the tactile space, the in-between space. So he is taking with redoing McLuhan, emphasizing what he later called cultural ecology or cultural content, not media ecology, cultural ecology. And he's running through all the cultural data that we have access to and had access to in the 50s and 60s and 70s that people didn't have access to in 100 years before or even 60 years before.
Mm-hmm.
So the formal analysis that McLuhan used slips into a content analysis just due to the abundance for baby boomers of cultural information and imagery.
You know, what's interesting is that in any human being born today is probably going to recapitulate all these stages of cultural development that Thompson talks about, beginning at 9,000 BC, moving to 3,500, 1,800, and so on. Every human being, you know, while in the womb, goes through, you know, has looks like a fish, and then has a tail like a monkey, and then starts developing more human features, and then comes out of the womb, and then is just you know, floating around in probably right hemisphere, and then starts to develop a little left hemisphere, and goes probably recapitulates the whole stages right up until they turn 18 or whatever.
Yep. And then they have to deal with the electronic tactile society of making every day a new reality, which no civilization lived in as massive as we have it. I mean,
yeah. Well, we don't all have to worry about making, because we got people making every day a new reality for us. Anchor people and the news people and the president.
No. They create the world. They make the world, but you have to make a pattern in relation to it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to process it, fit it into your user's content self.
Right.
The interesting thing is I have Thompson on my chart as a product of the instant replay. And I told him that in 99, 2000 at a seminar he held that he was replaying the instant replay as art form. That was the hidden technology in his pattern. Because we just had a quick 5-minute instant replay of the history of culture. And you could do that by the 70s because we had moved into a post-cultural immeasurable indifferent to history. So that Thompson replays literary sensibility here, the idea of a history of progression. And you could say the progression happened, but he doesn't deal with the sensory changes. He has a kind of constant complementary dialectic goes through all of his history. We will come up to that in a future. I mean, just in this section we read, he has the male and the female. The female kind of dominates, leads in the first phases, and then becomes content when the civilized patriarchal male structure dominates the woman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a long quote.
Now, McLuhan talks about, you know, the discarnate super angel, but Thompson, you know, in present time, Thompson talks about this kind of this sort of technological angel made of music and mathematics.
Right. He thinks the Gothic cathedrals were inspired by angels because he is including, not being a Catholic, he's including the other dimensions, what he calls the subtle realms, the subtle bodies, or what we can call the astral body. He includes that as a part of human culture, and he says, he intuits that angels hovered over, angelic dimensions hovered over the making of the Gothic cathedrals. And he's saying now, with the incredible miniaturization and implosion of humans and machines, a symbiosis, is that we're creating a new kind of virtual reality angel that is creating and resonating with the singularity we're in. Is that what you meant?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that gives you a different image of this discarnate angel that that McLuhan talked about, it gives it a little bit of form and shape and color, and you can sort of almost imagine it.
Yeah, McLuhan as a Catholic sticks with this body, what I call the chemical body, in its senses. He does not bring in the astral body images.
Yeah.
Maybe as a
no, but he does talk about the discarnate super angel, but when you try to think about it, it's like thinking about the void.
Yeah, so that Thompson tries to, by including non-Catholic cultural imagery, he tries to image the super angelic.
Yeah.
Now, isn't it interesting that he comes up with this angelic pattern for the singularity? And I don't know if he conceives of it as the super angelic, like McLuhan did, the super angelic being, that an angel could be wherever it wanted to be, but when it was there, wherever it wanted to be, that's all it was. That's where it was. It was limited to that. Then it could go somewhere else. It's like remote viewing or astral projecting. But the super angel is the electronic effect of everybody being everywhere simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
That's super angel. And so what you find is that Thompson develops on McLuhan, whether he was aware of it or not, but doesn't get the same effect as McLuhan, misses the technological dimension, and that's why I would say he limits Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, now towards the end of the quote we just read, he defaults to Sri Aurobindo, which talking about the descent of the supramental.
Yeah.
Which is sort of anthropomorphizing McLuhan's, you know, technological super angel.
In a sense, he falls back into visual space.
Mm-hmm.
He really is a bookish guy. Now, he changes later and updates the images we've just read. He realizes he was too nature-oriented. He had to confront virtual reality or the super angelic technological situation that McLuhan talked about. He had to confront that more and more by the 90s.
Uh-huh.
And he drops, he says that he was limited in his thinking in the 70s. And I think we might
look at all the guys that he was hanging out with at Lindisfarne. Well, I guess he was hanging out. Well, the Margulis, Lovelock, and then the Dalai Lama, and these rishis and roshis and yogis, and they're
all the Aquarian conspirators.
Yeah, they're all nature guys.
Yeah, and the other, there was Lynn Margulis, James Lovelock, Francisco Varela, and Ralph Abraham, I think, were the four. He writes a poem to each one of them in the book Imaginary Landscape in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he says that he was too much into the non-scientific in the 70s. He found that metaphor didn't work by the early 80s, and he started adopting more scientific models, but dancing on the scientific model's toes and correcting them from his yogic or subtle body perspective. I think I have a quote later where he explains the change in himself.
Just as a footnote, he was collaborating with Ralph Abraham when he wrote The Imaginary Landscape, and then
The later book, Transforming History.
Well, that would have been, but he knew Ralph Abraham
for 20 years.
Same thing, Terrence McKenna, who knew Ralph Abraham, wrote a book called The Invisible. Wrote a book called The Invisible Landscape. And it was published probably around the same time as Thompson's Imaginary Landscape.
Well, The Invisible Landscape, I think they wrote in the 70s in the jungles, right? He and his brother?
Yeah, that was the inspiration for it. I don't know if it was written down there or stuff.
Right.
Nucleus of the book was formed down there.
I don't know when Invisible Landscape finally came out, but Food of the Gods came out in late 80s, early 90s, the same time as Thompson's Imaginary Landscape. But in one level, they're all closet McLuhanites, whether they know it or not, using McLuhan's ideas or memes and redoing them and adapting them to the present that McLuhan was not around for.
Mm-hmm.
But what was I going to say about Thompson is that it's interesting, like you find that he calls this super angelic singularity later in his visions that you're hearing on the tapes of the 90s that you're processing right now. He talks about it as a mathematical vision, right?
And mathematic and musical.
See, there's the romanticization of acoustic space. It's almost like Thompson is describing McLuhan's tactile space, but he has to make it music because he romanticizes the oral.
Right.
Because he's a basic POB, print-oriented.
Well, he loves, he cut his teeth on Bach. he just, that music is ecstatic to him, and he thinks that that's better than matter, I think.
Right.
And plus he keeps referring to Heisenberg, who's saying that, well, there is no substantiality to matter. It's all quarks, and when you look at that, it's just patterns of information that can be looked at as mathematical or musical in nature.
Yeah, now he's hoiking up cultural scientific content, and he's not seeing that those images just are evoked by radio environments or the TV environments. He does not want to look at the Kuhn called the formal causality. He's looking at the material causality of cultural content. And when you said he finds a limit to matter, his view of matter would be McLuhan's visual space.
Mm-hmm.
The particulate matter is visual space. And the musical matter.
Well, no, I don't know. When he talks about the distinction between matter and, you know, he talks about, like, in the matter as being, you know, sexual and regenerative and wild and sort of chaotic, and then he contrasts that with, you know, Plato's ideals, the ideal perfected eternal realm that never changes, and
but that dialectic of the ideal, the Platonic ideal, and the Aristotelian sensual is the dialectic that visual space creates.
Oh.
Primitive man, wild, anarchic, intuitive, preliterate humans do not have that dialectic that wouldn't even occur to them. They just are.
I keep forgetting that visual space goes all the way back to Sumer.
Yeah. Writing.
Because I always tend to start thinking, well, visual space really takes off with the phonetic alphabet and then the printing press. But, you know, I guess when you're dealing with hieroglyphs and cuneiform, those cuneiform things, you're already in visual space. He says language separates the conscious and the subconscious, and you don't even need visual space for that.
Yes, whereas McLuhan would say there is no unconscious in preliterate man.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, visual space in McLuhan terms is the effect of the phonetic alphabet. But there, every now and then McLuhan would talk broader terms and just talk about the effect of writing in general, and that's Sumerian, you know, or an Egyptian. But those writing societies were very different from the Greek society. They didn't have the sense of the individual. Their writings did not create the emphasis on the individual psyche that the Greek phonetic alphabet.
No, but they were already separating, they were already subjugating the female and relegating it to the dimension of the unconscious. That's what the whole patriarchal thing was about, and that began in Sumer.
Yeah, began with the writing, and what he calls, what Thompson calls the civilization phase,
mm-hmm.
3500 B.C. Now, as McLuhan would say that he wrote cartoons, Thompson is writing cartoons, you know, broad strokes of the history of culture. Anybody in a particular discipline who was a specialist and had expert knowledge would argue with the statements that Thompson makes on the details, just as they would argue with McLuhan. So Thompson here is doing a modern poetic pattern. He was awarded a poet's prize, I think, in the 80s by Norway,
mm-hmm.
at least nominated, but they recognized that his writings were more along the realm of poetry, even though they weren't your traditional content for poetry, because they were essays and they dealt with the non-poetic,
mm-hmm.
mathematical and scientific. So, but Thompson was encyclopedic, which is what you had to be a 20th century poet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I was wondering if I should reread what you wrote, even though it's long. Can we take that?
Yeah.
Just to get a whiff of the vast, broad patterns he's weaving. Maybe there'll be things I'll comment on as we go through it again.
Well, if you can do it in 8 minutes, we got 10 minutes on this tape, so yeah, you can do it.
Okay, so redoing what Scott read and see what we evoke. He says, it is absurd to give a lecture in 5 minutes, so I'm going to be even more absurd to try to give a mini-lecture on one end of history to the other in 4.5 minutes. The geologists who spoke before me have tried to give us a sense of where we are as a way of gaining a sense of where we are going. So I want to talk about history by talking about cultural change. Not media, formal change, cultural change, I'm saying. About six great cultural transformations, the harmonization of the primates, symbolization and the origins of notation and art in the upper Paleolithic. See, that's not writing, that's symbolization, right? pictorial, you could say. Agriculturalization in 9000 BC, civilization in 3500 BC, industrialization in the 18th century AD, and the cultural transformation we are in now, planetization.
So hold on a sec. Why did you make a distinction between cultural and media?
Well, he's talking about cultural change, whereas McLuhan talks about technological media changes, cultural content. Culture is more the content in different cultures' reaction, different linguistic geographic groupings' response to a general technology.
Okay. All right.
Like you have Egyptian writing and Sumerian writing and Chinese writing, all different cultures in response to the invention of early ideographic and pictographic language.
Right.
Or writing. Right?
Right.
The first one, the hominization of the primates, should be called the feminization of the primates because it all started when we got kicked out of the forest in the Pliocene era, and we became so scared being out in the open, subject to predation, that the females unconsciously lured the males around them by abandoning the old estrus system and becoming open to sexuality at all times. So the males left palling around with their buddies in the old male pair bonding pattern and clustered around the females. Next thing you know, there is a whole new setup, with the males scrounging and the females gathering. That created the basic division of labor between male and female. So the origins of human culture come from women, and so, thank you, since I'm a cultural historian, that's important to me. The cultural historian, not a media historian. The women did it again in the next big change, symbolization. When language began to emerge, it really split consciousness by creating the unconscious and the conscious. Like an island rising out of the sea, language was a piece of the old ocean floor held up to new light, and the symbol, like a piece of coral or a rock, could help to relate the one to the other. One, you know, the beginning of early abstraction. I'm saying that. One seemingly small thing which helped relate the one to the other was menstruation, for it established the first observable periodicities between the phases of the moon and the internal life of the womb, with ovulation at the full and menstruation at the dark of the moon. With ovulation at the full moon and menstruation at the dark of the moon. In observing this synchronicity between their bodies and nature, and in keeping track of the 10 lunar months of pregnancy on the lunar tally sticks of the midwife, woman was the first to establish a system of notation and symbolism upon which all later calendrical systems are based. So, the roots of science, as opposed to Marshak, a scholar, probably a male scholar, who says men were the roots of science, Thompson's saying the roots of science are with women. Contra Marshak. It's the story of the Great Mother holding up the lunar calendar incised on the crescent of the bison's horn, the well-known Venus of Lausanne. That's cave art. And not the story of the Great Father with the phallic wand. The third basic change came again from women when, through gathering wild cereals, they discovered that they could collect enough food in 3 weeks to last an entire year. Women and children could collect more food than man the hunter could ever kill. But the food required storage and heavy grinding bins, and so they began to settle down to create agriculture in the Neolithic village. Unfortunately, agriculture gave us enough of a surplus that men had some time on their hands. Since they now had, quote, property, unquote, which could be taken away, the men found that trading and raiding could be as exciting as the old days of the hunt, and so warfare came into being. After the domestication of plants and animals and agriculturalization came the next big change, the domestication of women or civilization. Warfare enabled the old custom-bound religious matrilineal society of the Neolithic village to grow into the great city with its patriarchal structure, its great male gods, its religiously controlled economic surplus, and its standing armies. Small wonder that the Sumerian goddess Inanna comes to the great male god Enki and says, quote, I, the woman, why did you treat differently? Where are my prerogatives? Unquote. Enki, the male god, responds by saying, quote, Enki perfected greatly that which was woman's task. So there's the implying of the male redid the female as art form. Right? Perfected it.
Domesticated it.
Yeah, I mean, the woman is a cook, the man becomes a chef. No, domestication is earlier. Woman becomes domesticated.
That's
woman
what I'm
becomes
saying.
Here.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. But the particular tasks that women did have become art forms. So the cook becomes a chef. A chef. A woman as a cook is a mere housewife, but a man is a chef. Woman may have invented the lunar tally stick, but man takes it over to create writing, the measurement of wealth in the temple storehouse. From 3500 BC to the 18th century AD, all the civilizations of the world are agrarian. But then in Great Britain, another big change comes along, and we get the next transformation, industrialization. Industrialization is really an intensification of civilization. Now, that's interesting. Industrialization, the printing press, from McLuhan's point of view, intensified the effect of the phonetic alphabet, right? But McLuhan would say industrialization is kinetic space. So we have a combination of the printing press and industrial technology, which Thompson calls industrialization, as really an intensification of civilization. And so through science and technology, the culture becomes even more patriarchal and militaristic than its Sumerian ancestor. In homonization, the old forest home had been absorbed into the clump of trees, the new home base for the hominids. So the jungle becomes a clump of trees as they move out into the savanna. In symbolization, the animals were absorbed into artistic images on stones and cave walls. So he's going to start talking about this miniaturization or absorbing process. In agriculturalization, the plants were absorbed, and in civilization, women were absorbed. In each case of cultural absorption, there was an attendant process of miniaturization. First, the forest had been miniaturized in the clump of trees of the home base. Then the animals had been miniaturized into an artistic image and time into an artistic image, and time was miniaturized in a lunar tally stick. Then plants were miniaturized in a garden, and finally women in Neolithic matrilineal culture were miniaturized in the patriarchal household. In the 18th century, all nature was surrounded and miniaturized by culture. Now, McLuhan would say iconic technology.
The miniaturization, the way that he's using it here, is another way of saying conceptualized or conceptualization. But
or figure. It becomes art form or programmable. It's familiar.